Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden.
There are over 20 million Catholics in China, heroically keeping the faith in the face of one of the most brutally repressive political regimes that the world's ever known. Perhaps one of the most troubling and disturbing aspects of the present era of church politics has been the secret concord that the Vatican entered into with the Chinese Communist Party. There's no doubt that having two Catholic ecclesial bodies, one official recognized by the state and one unofficial and underground, presented a situation that was ecclesially, spiritually, and politically problematic at so many levels, and the Concord set out to help improve that. But as all of those who follow this drama know very well, the question has been, at what price? Admirers of the heroic and saintly Cardinal Zen have also been deeply concerned about his role in the present political dramas, with too much real information being unavailable. Who better to turn to for comment and analysis than Benedict Rogers? He's the co-founder and deputy chairman of the Conservative Party's Human Rights Commission and also founder and CEO of Hong Kong Watch. He's also a member of the advisory group of the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. And so I asked Ben to describe how he fell in love with China and developed his expertise on the Catholic Church there. And we talk about his conversion from Anglicanism to Catholicism and his extraordinary journey politically and spiritually. Many of those who listen will want to know much more than we had time to discuss, and so may want to buy Ben's recent book. It's called The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny. So for a brief and fascinating introduction to Benedict Rogers' work and an updated analysis of what's happening now and may happen in the future, Ben joins me on Merely Catholic.
Benedict Rogers, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for agreeing to appear on this show. I'm going to be fascinated with what you have to say, and I shall leave this much better educated, and I guess also perhaps a bit more miserable, at least miserable in terms of sharing the sufferings of the persecuted church. Benedict, would you mind beginning by telling us a little bit about yourself? How on earth have you come to be an authority on Chinese Christianity? Was it something that was fed to you with your mother's milk or in your early reading? How did it happen?
Well, it wasn't fed to me with my mother's milk. The beginning was when I was 18 years old and I decided to have a gap year between school and university. And I wanted to go to a part of the world. My family was actually very well traveled, but I wanted to go somewhere that, you know, the rest of the family had never been to before, and that was totally new for any of us. And I ended up applying for a placement to teach English in the city of Qingdao on the east coast of China, famous actually for the best beer in China, although that wasn't the reason I chose it. It was a nice discovery once I was there. And I had an enormously happy 6 months teaching English in Qingdao, fell in love with China in terms of the people, the culture, the country, the history, and never looked back and went on to study Chinese studies, then lived in Hong Kong, where I worked as a journalist, my first job in life after graduation. And that happened to be the first 5 years after the handover of Hong Kong. And then traveled regularly in and around China. But I also diverged to other parts of Asia and spent many years working on Burma or Myanmar, where in fact that was the place I became a Catholic 10 years ago, received into the church by Myanmar's cardinal, the Archbishop of Yangon, Cardinal Charles Bo. That's a whole other story, which you're welcome to come back to if you want to.
I think we might very well come back to it properly, but I'm not going to let you off quite so easily. Let's take a 3-minute detour. How did you become a Catholic in Burma? 3 minutes, but a haiku conversion story.
Absolutely. Well, essentially, I had been working in Burma for some time with the ethnic minorities and on the human rights situation. And in the course of that work, I came to know Archbishop Charles Bo, as he then was. It was before he was cardinal. We became friends. He inspired me. And one night over dinner, well, actually over a glass of whiskey before dinner, I started asking questions about the Catholic Church. And I was already a Christian. I was an Anglican. But the conversation ended with Cardinal Bo saying to me, basically, when someone can accept the teachings of the Catholic Church, they're ready to become a Catholic. It was as simple as that. But he added something I didn't expect. He said, if you ever find yourself in that position, I would receive you into the church here in Burma. And that just had a beautiful appeal to me, given my association with the country. And so I went off for 2 years and explored it and talked to Catholic friends, read very widely, read the Catechism, read the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church, read encyclicals. And at the end of 2 years, I went back to him and said, if your invitation's still open, I'm on. And Lord Alton, David Alton, came out to Burma with me as my sponsor into the church.
Gosh, well, you don't do it by halves. Can I just say it's a very impressive story and congratulations. And I understand the force of it entirely, having trod ideologically and spiritually a similar path. Well, congratulations and well done on cracking it earlier in life than I managed to. Let's go back to the Chinese. Could you give us a brief history of Catholicism in China?
Catholicism came to China, you know, very early on, hundreds of years ago. Christianity as a whole came. The Nestorians came to China. But perhaps one of the key turning points, and this relates obviously to the current Pope's position on China, was the example of Matteo Ricci, the great Jesuit, who essentially became, for all intents and purposes, Chinese. He dressed like a Chinese. He learned the language. And he won for himself and therefore for the faith, a position of real influence in the imperial court. From there, the church in China grew. Of course, it suffered hugely at different points, particularly under Mao's rule, the Cultural Revolution. It was driven pretty much completely underground, although not destroyed. And then it came back above ground in the last few decades as China started to open up, but is now again facing real persecution.
The numbers, though, are huge, aren't they? I mean, they're mind-boggling to a Western Catholic. Do you have any at your fingertips?
Well, it's obviously difficult to get exact numbers, but it's, I think, a generally accepted number for Christians in total, Catholics and Protestants, is probably around the 100 million, maybe as high as 120 million mark. And of those, the vast majority are Protestants, but I think it's probably fair to say that at least 20 million would be Catholics. That's a sort of guesstimate, but I think it's a respected guesstimate.
So that's really quite interesting. 20% Catholic and 80% Protestant. The Catholics were doing most of the worldwide evangelization until the 19th century. How did the Protestants catch up so quickly in China?
Well, I think there were probably a lot more Protestant missionaries that came in the 20th century. There were great figures like Gladys Aylward, who was instrumental as a missionary in a lot of social reform in China, particularly trying to end the practice of foot binding. Women facing this incredibly painful, cruel cultural tradition of binding their feet. So that probably had an impact, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why the Protestant Church grew. Of course, the Catholic Church in China under the communist rule has faced this great challenge of being divided, of the underground Catholic Church being in communion with Rome, the state-approved above-ground church, until relatively recently, generally not being in communion with Rome. And that perhaps has been an impediment for the Catholic Church spreading in China in a way that Protestants, you know, they haven't been encumbered with that, although they faced other forms of severe persecution.
So when you say they haven't been encumbered with that, do you mean they've remained underground?
I correct myself because there is, of course, a state-controlled Protestant church as well. But I guess what I meant by that is that, you know, for Catholics, having that incredibly painful division of those who call themselves Catholics but are not able to openly be in communion with Rome and those who are underground and are therefore wholeheartedly in communion with Rome, that's a bigger division within the Catholic community than is the case for Protestants who don't have to think about communion with the outside world, as it were.
Yes, of course. I mean, and I think, thank you for explaining that, because I think it's probably quite important. I mean, it would be ecclesiologically immensely dispiriting to have two kinds of Catholics. You're only supposed to have one kind of Catholic by definition. So it would rather take some of the steam out of the sense of unitive purpose of being a Catholic. Well, let's go to Pope Francis's pact. That took everyone by surprise, because it seemed, even to the ordinary person, to either to be the act of a political ingenue, or an act of something rather darker. So what did you think at the time, and what do you think now?
I remember writing effectively an open letter as a very new young Catholic. I was only a few years old, a toddler Catholic. And I wrote this article, which was presented as an open letter to the Holy Father when this agreement was rumoured, actually before it was signed. I wrote it in a way that I hope was very respectful, was trying to be understanding of the Pope's motives, you know, the desire to unify the church in China, the romantic association with Matteo Ricci's legacy. Those are all very good, noble intentions. But I wrote this piece warning that now isn't the time to do this deal and that the Chinese Communist Party isn't a partner that can be trusted. And so I was urging caution. Then the agreement was signed, and I wrote a few pieces, again, trying to give the Pope and the Vatican the benefit of the doubt and expressing my concerns, but saying, you know, I might be wrong. Maybe they know something. Well, I'm sure they know lots of things that I don't know. And maybe they have a plan that can overcome the concerns I have. Now we are, 5 years on from the agreement. It's been renewed twice. And now I'm very, very troubled by it because, first of all, the agreement itself is still a secret document. And if it's such a good deal, why can't we know the details of what's in it? What we do know about it is that it gives the regime in Beijing a huge role in the appointment of bishops, which in itself is ironic because it's an avowedly atheist communist dictatorship. But what's also concerning about it is that it has been rolled over twice with seemingly no scrutiny, no transparency, no real review of its effectiveness. And then thirdly, and most importantly, it has not led to what I presume was the intention, which was an improvement in religious freedom and a unity for Catholics in China. On the contrary, it's led to a worsening of the situation. And accompanying that, it has led to the effective silence of Pope Francis on issues of religious freedom and human rights in China. And when you think that this is a Pope that is very vocal on themes of human rights and justice around the world, barely a Sunday goes by without him speaking out on one issue of injustice or conflict in the world or another. He has said virtually nothing about the persecution of Christians in China, the genocide of the Uyghurs, the dismantling of Hong Kong's freedoms. And also, I believe he's the first pope in recent times, you know, in the last few decades, to refuse to meet with the Dalai Lama. And all of these factors are very disturbing.
I'm often acting as a devil's advocate, and I don't often get the chance to be a Holy Father advocate. So let me press you a little bit further. Is it the case, is it possible that there are within the Vatican sort of Sino-Vaticano experts who are playing a long game? I mean, you yourself said that to have a divided Catholic community produces a sort of an existential and ecclesial wound that runs very deep indeed. It's been 5 years, but that's not a long time in church history. Are they playing the long game? Is there a benefit in long-term healing and unitive reparation that we can't see that's going to cause and is causing a degree of short-term considerable pain? Is that it, or is that not credible in your view?
I'm sure that's what they would say. I think my comment on that would be, given how the Chinese Communist Party has proven time and time again that it is not a partner to be trusted, it has broken its word on countless occasions, not just in this context, but in many other international agreements. They would have to be thinking of a very, very long game, which is coming at a very high price. The price of the Holy Father's silence on these issues, but also the price of, I think, a lot of Catholics in China who have suffered a lot and continue to suffer a lot, feeling betrayed and feeling rather abandoned. Quite a number of Catholic underground bishops have actually been asked, not by Beijing, but in fact by Rome, to retire, to step aside in favor of Beijing-appointed bishops as part of this attempt to unify the underground church with the state church. And that has understandably caused a lot of pain for those who for decades have been loyal to Rome and then suddenly are pushed to one side. And one crucial thing that I think I didn't mention earlier, there appears to have been no attempt really to set as a condition for the agreement the release of those who clergy and indeed lay people, but especially clergy, priests and bishops who are in prison. In my view, if you're going to come to an agreement like this, you should at least as a precondition seek the release of those who are in jail. And that hasn't happened. In fact, more people have been jailed. So they may be playing a long game. I'm sure that's what they would say. But it seems to me that it's coming at a very high price. And if it's going to lead to anything, it's going to be a very long game, because I can't see the current regime doing anything other than taking advantage of it and breaking their promises and putting the church in an even worse position.
One of the things that slowed me down becoming a Catholic were the rumours of Pope Pius XII's incompetence during the Second World War and his passivity in front of Hitler. I'm very pleased to say that in the last 5 years or so, as scholarship has gone up to date and my readings tried to keep up with it, we discovered that the opposite was the case, that Pope Pius XII was in fact working enormously hard behind the scenes, because he was threatened with the extermination of whole villages and towns if he said anything in public. So he was silenced and instead led an extremely competent and complex diplomatic strategy behind the scenes to undermine Nazism instead. Is there any chance that the Vatican is pursuing the same policy at the moment, do you think?
I guess that is a possibility, and I certainly agree with you that we learn from history a lot more about that situation than people would have known at the time. And so I'm certainly willing to accept that there may be things going on that we're not aware of, and history may show things in a better light. I should emphasize that I'm not one of those that is anti the current Pope. I came into the church actually about 10 days after he became Pope. So I've grown up with him, and there are many things about him that I love. So this is not an anti-Francis sort of campaign. But I think that even if he is trying to do those things behind the scenes, there could be more he could say in public that would reassure people. And he doesn't have to speak out with an outright condemnation or take a confrontational line or a political line. But just if he, perhaps when he speaks in St. Peter's Square, you know, after the Angelus, if he prayed more often for the church in China, for the Uyghurs, for Tibetans, for Hong Kong, you know, that's surely what the Pope does, is to pray. And I think if he prayed or expressed his prayers for China publicly, that would send a reassuring signal to a lot of people who are otherwise very worried about his positioning.
I'm sure there's a department in the Vatican that whose duty it is to listen to the Catholic Herald and our podcast, and I'm sure your message and advice will have got through. It sounds like it's very good advice indeed. I'm so glad that we are able to offer a platform of international media probity to let it happen. Since I've done everything I can to represent the other side, it was a bit odd having McCarrick being sent to do the deal, wasn't it? What do we make of that?
Yes, I don't really know what to make of it. I know what I read both about him and his involvement in this. Obviously, you know, his wider story is extremely disturbing. It is odd.
It didn't help, did it? I mean, here we are. You and I are both trying to help the situation, where you're bringing a degree of forensic analysis and awareness of what the issues are, and I'm trying because it's my duty to put both sides, and so we are. But in terms of, you're quite rightly saying, there are a number of things that would help, including the Pope's offering subtle and diplomatic words of support to the Chinese Christians, which wouldn't enrage the regime. To have Cardinal McCarrick, either he had a very distinguished record of Sinaitic competence when it came to diplomacy, or else something we don't know. But it's not easy for the average person looking at this and saying, the whole thing is difficult, and this just makes it more difficult.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, I should say that I've spoken to prominent Catholics who are very much supporters of Pope Francis. I mean, one I can certainly name, because he's spoken publicly himself about these issues, is the last governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, who, you know, generally is on Pope Francis's wavelength. And yet he has said publicly and to me privately, he just can't understand where this is going or why this is happening. And he's spoken to senior people in the Vatican who have just not been able to explain it either. One thing I should say, both as something that was a concern, although I now would give Pope Francis credit over it, is that it was very odd that for a long time, one of the most senior cardinals in Asia, and in fact the only Chinese cardinal, Cardinal Joseph Zen, who's been an outspoken critic of this agreement and a really courageous voice for religious freedom and human rights, could not get an audience with Pope Francis. And if you remember, during the pandemic, he traveled to Rome to seek an audience and was refused. And the idea of the Pope refusing an audience to a 90-year-old cardinal, one of his most senior cardinals in the region, was just staggering and deeply upsetting. Now, where I give Pope Francis some credit is that to a certain extent, he rectified that by then meeting Cardinal Zen at Pope Benedict's funeral, where he could have actually had a more legitimate excuse for declining, because he could have said, look, I'm busy with my predecessor's funeral. But to be fair, he did meet Cardinal Zen, and photographs were taken and photographs were put out in the media. And so there was no attempt to hide that meeting. So I do acknowledge that as one small step that is in the right direction.
I was going to ask you about Cardinal Zen, if only because one has to looks at his face. One sees it radiating from inside with integrity. And I think one would say a certain kind of profound spirituality. He's paid an enormously high price himself. And as you say, it was really very difficult for those of us watching him try and gain an audience. Can you tell us a little bit about his life and his influence? Presumably, he's going to die soon and he'll be revered as a saint, perhaps even a martyr. So can you give us a brief resume of Cardinal Zen and what you think of his influence?
Absolutely. I've had the privilege of knowing him for quite some time. When I lived in Hong Kong, long before I was a Catholic, he was the coadjutor bishop of Hong Kong at that time, and I met him on a number of occasions. I was very active on the situation in East Timor at that time, and he became very supportive of what I was trying to do. Then for many years, we lost contact, and then we renewed contact in recent years because of the situation in Hong Kong and China and my involvement. And he is a remarkable man. He's incredibly both courageous, but also humble and wise. He's always taken care to make it clear that his criticism is not of Pope Francis personally, it's of the deal that the Vatican has done with China. And he's in really the best place to comment on these issues because he was born in Shanghai, so he's not actually from Hong Kong, he's from mainland China, came to Hong Kong early in his life. He's a Salesian. He was an educator in Hong Kong, and then became the coadjutor bishop, then the bishop, and then one of the cardinals. And of course, Hong Kong now has three cardinals living because the Pope has just recently appointed the new bishop, Stephen Chow, as a cardinal. But Cardinal Zen is a real hero. And as you say, we will miss him incredibly when he does die. I think he is, whether he's recognized as such or not, he is a saint and a hero, and he hasn't died yet, so we can't say he whether or not he'll be a martyr, but certainly he's a saint.
Can I ask you some questions of general education about China and the underground church? If we compare what's happening in China with what happened in Russia, to everyone's enormous surprise in 1989, for a whole series of unique reasons, that the regime collapsed, and a situation where there had been very few Orthodox Christians indeed changed within a generation. And now I think between 60 and 70% of Russians identify as members of the Russian Orthodox Church, whatever that means and whatever it has. It's still the most extraordinary thing to happen. Now, China has been very much more canny in the way it's allowed its Marxism to develop and to become semi-capitalized. And so it's not the same, and we can't expect the same to happen. But do you have any views on the stability of Chinese Marxism and whether or not there's any hope at all? If I was a Chinese Catholic and saying to you, Benedict, with your view outside in the West and what you've seen happen historically, what's going to happen to us? Is there any chance of our experiencing the kind of liberation or renewal of Orthodoxy in Russia? What would you have any view on that?
Yes, I mean, I'm a little bit more, I would say, cautiously hopeful. I don't want to exaggerate it, but a little bit more cautiously hopeful of the prospects for change at some point. I couldn't possibly put a time frame on it than I might have been a few years ago for several reasons. Firstly, I think under Xi Jinping's predecessors, who were much more pragmatist than he, he's a much more ideological leader, there was this sort of unspoken, unwritten deal between the Chinese Communist Party and the people of China that in return for delivering an economic miracle for the country and raising living conditions and wealth in the country for many, many people, and allowing us a limited space for some degree of personal freedom, including some limited freedom to practice religion. In return for that, the regime would have, if you like, its legitimacy. It would be recognized as the legitimate government of China. Now, under Xi Jinping, he has really dismantled that economic, or is in the process of dismantling that economic bargain, in the sense that, firstly, he's ideologically much more opposed to private enterprise. He's gone after a number of entrepreneurs who have fallen out with him. His extremely draconian total lockdown over COVID had real economic ramifications. And I think as China begins to slow down its economic growth, I mean, it's still obviously an incredibly important economic superpower, but as its growth slows down and perhaps its economic miracle begins to disintegrate, and at the same time, the regime is much, much more repressive than any of the regimes since Mao, I think we will start to see more and more discontent. And we are already starting to see that. We saw, of course, the protests against the COVID lockdown at the end of last year. And those protests were significant because it was the first time since the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989 that we heard large numbers of Chinese people across China not shouting, lift the COVID lockdown or ease the restrictions. Many of them were shouting, Chinese Communist Party step down, Xi Jinping step down. And that was really extraordinary. The other thing I'm also seeing is that more Chinese living abroad are starting to speak out. There are Chinese students in the UK, for example, who in the past would have been very much either silent or promoting the party's propaganda. But now an increasing number of them are holding protests in London. For example, on June the 4th, the anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre, they organized a protest in London. I've met recently with a number of mainland Chinese who are very critical of the party and want change. They may be small in number, and that's what I it's difficult to quantify the scale of the dissent, but I do detect dissent growing. And at some point in the future, I think that could lead to change.
Yes, I mean, that's very interesting indeed. And one has no idea whether or not the presence of 20 million Catholics, what effect in terms of leverage that will have for or against change. In terms of geopolitical tensions, of which I'm only an amateur, but I'm sure you're better read, there's a sense that after the Russian-Ukraine tragedy reaches some kind of stalemate or whatever's going to happen, that the real stresses are going to have to do with China and Taiwan and difficulties between China and America. Do you have any insight as to how those stresses might develop and whether or not the presence of 20 million Catholics in China will have any particular effect in terms of the way the balance shifts as the power struggle develops?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, a few years ago, I would have been quite dismissive of anyone who was talking about the possibility of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, a military conflict over Taiwan. A few years ago, I didn't think that was very likely. I now have to acknowledge that it is an increasingly likely possibility. That doesn't mean I'm saying it's going to happen, but I certainly think it's a possibility that we need to be prepared for. I think that the intention of Xi Jinping is clearly to take Taiwan. I think he sees himself, he sees everything in terms of his legacy. And if he thinks that Mao's legacy was the founding of the People's Republic of China, Deng Xiaoping's legacy was the economic opening and growth of China, he may well be seeing his legacy as what he would call the reunification of China with Taiwan. Although it's important to remember that he's wrong to say reunification, because Taiwan was never historically part of China. So I think that the dangers of those tensions increasing are very strong. I think, on the other hand, he will also know that he will have watched Putin's invasion of Ukraine and seen it hasn't gone entirely Putin's way. So he will be calculating, can he do it with success? Because he'll know that if he tries and fails or gets bogged down in a long drawn out conflict, that could well lead to his downfall and possibly even the party's downfall. So I think we know what his intentions are, but we can't put a time frame on it. But it's clear that he's preparing the Chinese military for conflict in the future. And he himself has has said that. So in terms of the influence of Catholics, I mean, what's significant about Taiwan is that, of course, the Holy See is one of the few states that has diplomatic relations with Taiwan rather than China. And one of the things that worries me about the Vatican's agreement with Beijing is that heading in the direction of changing that diplomatic relationship? I hope not. But that is a factor. And I think that Catholics in Taiwan have the opportunity to appeal to the Vatican, and Catholics in China, at the very least, I'm sure, are praying.
So this is very interesting. Thank you so much for taking us here. I hoped you might. And I think it's a very important way to end the podcast. What is Catholicism in Taiwan like? I mean, you've partly answered this by saying that there would be, you know, it would quite clearly be a role of the Catholic Church to reach out to the rest of the West, to the Pope and through the Pope. But is Taiwan a Catholic country?
It's certainly a country with a significant Catholic presence. And of course, you know, the difference between Taiwan and China in terms of religious freedom is the difference between day and night. You know, Taiwan is a place of vibrant religious freedom. In 2019, I actually attended not one, but two conferences on religious freedom in Taiwan, both of which were opened by the president of Taiwan. The vice president, I believe, at the time, although I think it has changed, but the vice president at the time was a devout Catholic, and there were Catholics in very influential positions in government, in business. So yes, it's definitely a place with significant Catholic influence.
Ben, this has been really interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time and trouble. I've learned an enormous amount, and I know our listeners will too. You've been turned away from Hong Kong. You've not been allowed back in. Are you ever going to be able to go back and visit?
Well, the only way that I could go back to Hong Kong and visit is if things change for the better in Hong Kong. And the only way that's going to happen is if things change in China itself. Not only was I denied entry to Hong Kong in 2017, but I've since been threatened formally by the Hong Kong police, claiming that I'm in violation of Hong Kong's national security law by virtue of what I do here in the UK and the rest of the world. And they specifically said I could face a prison sentence. So that's not something I particularly want to experience. So I won't go back to Hong Kong. I won't be able to until Hong Kong is free.
It won't be the place you take your next holiday. No.
It won't. No.
It's been marvellous to talk, and we're very grateful for all the expertise and insight you brought to this. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.